Affairs.
This is Akashvani. In the weekly program Current Affairs, now we bring a discussion on expanding conflict in West Asia and its global repercussions. The participants are Atul Aneja, strategic analyst, and Professor Rahul Mishra, international affairs expert. The moderator is Tina Jha, journalist.
Namaskar to all the listeners of Akashvani. My name is Tina Jha. The conflict involving Iran is fast emerging as one of the most consequential geopolitical crises of our time. What began as a military escalation is now sending ripple effects across the global economy, which is disrupting energy supplies, rattling the shipping routes, and also raising fears of a wider regional war. At the center of this crisis lies the Strait of Hormuz, one of the world's most critical energy choke points. With tanker traffic disrupted and oil prices already surging, analysts warn of a major disruption to global oil supply. For India, the stakes are particularly high. A large share of our crude oil imports moves through the Gulf. Any disruption in these sea lanes can quickly translate into higher fuel prices, inflationary pressures, and most importantly, the supply chain challenges. So against this backdrop, New Delhi has stepped up its diplomatic outreach. Prime Minister Narendra Modi has been in touch with several leaders in the region, stressing the need for restraint, dialogue and diplomacy. External Affairs Minister Dr. S. Jaishankar has also been engaging with counterparts on shipping security and energy concerns. The challenge for India is not just economic, it's also strategic. West Asia remains vital for India's energy security, trade routes, but also the safety of millions of Indians who are living and working in the region. So as tensions rise, the key questions remain. Where does this conflict go from here? Could it expand into a wider regional confrontation? And what will it mean for global geopolitics, geoeconomics, and India's interests? That's what we will explore today with two distinguished guests. So let me introduce them to you. Immense pleasure to welcome Professor Rahul Mishra, he's international affairs expert, and Mr. Atul Aneja, he's a strategic analyst. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us on this broadcast. Professor, before we proceed into the discussion, help our listeners understand, give us a historical perspective of how things came to this kind of a situation, a little background on how things escalated so much that the United States and Israel had to come together and launch attack of this kind on Iran, even while the negotiations were underway. We've already heard, Oman, that negotiations were almost at the final stage.
If you take a look at the Israeli foreign policy and their security concerns, they've always been worried about the support that Hezbollah has been getting, Palestine has been getting from the Gulf region, from these countries. Iran has been directly supporting Hezbollah, and that has been a prime concern for Israel. And they have warned Iran and Hezbollah both that their operations or their terrorist attack have to stop in Israel. So the roots of this go back to 1960. When Iran was, of course, an established power in the region, and over a period of time, although Israel established its regional predominance, Iran has always been a country which was an outlier. It did not really abide by the regional balance of power system. It has always been equating itself with the U.S. So even now, if you look at all the statements coming from Iranian foreign ministry, they're not targeting Israel much. Their focus has always been on Iran. Their focus has always been on the U.S. And that has to do with the Iranian nuclear program. Iran willing to or trying to acquire nuclear capabilities. So if you look at this whole equation from Iranian perspective, for them, Israel is a sideshow. And that hurts Israel's interest, that hurts their image. So in this trilateral equation, Israel's concerns are related directly to Hezbollah, to terrorist attacks, and the fact that Iran supports them, state-sponsored terrorism, as they call it. For the U.S. side, denuclearizing, so-called denuclearization of Iran has been a target. For Iran, acquiring their nuclear capabilities, creating a regional balance of power, where even if they are not the hegemonic state, they have the power and the leverage to command and control the region per their wishes, and also in direct alignment with their policies vis-a-vis the U.S. So this sets the overall background. Of course, there are other players. Saudi Arabia, for example, is not happy with the situation going back to the millennia-old Shia-Sunni differences. But Saudi Arabia is another country that doesn't want Iran to gain more power, acquire more power. So this point that you mentioned about Iran, Israel, and the U.S. coming to the negotiating table, everything was finalized. The Iranian deputy foreign minister also mentioned this in the conference held recently in Delhi. that they were backstabbed, that diplomatic channels were on and everything was being considered, and suddenly this happened. The attack on Iran happened because both the American and Israeli interests aligned, and top up was the Saudi interest, because Mohammed bin Salman did not want Iran to project its power and capabilities and reach a stage where Iran acquires nuclear capability. So in the wider balance of power game, none of these countries wanted Iran to have a position where they could have a stronger say in the regional balance of power. And that has led to this situation.
So, Mr. Anija, is that a backtracking by the United States and Israel, along with some countries in the Arab world, perhaps led to the retaliation of the kind that we are seeing from Iran, but also the fact that it will deter them in the days to come to come to the negotiating table, given what happened just before the start of the war?
Yeah, because the rules changed the day the attacks took place. And so it will be a completely different equation now. You have a new leadership coming in Iran, which is far more, if not far more, definitely more hardline than one which has gone. And uncompromising, giving up. So it's a complete change, a turnaround. You know, they're not being nice to each other anymore. It's time that they have arrived at a situation of a fundamental change in the region and across the world. Because if this region resources changes its equations, it will have its own effects, seismic effects, if I may say, across the entire global system, which will have to readjust completely from what it is now. From unipolar, we went to quasi-multipolar, but perhaps fully multipolar after this.
And what kind of readjustments and realignments do you see emerging once the war stops within the region?
Within the region, there are many scenarios. But what appears today is if Iran gets its way through, then Iran emerges as the most powerful nation in the region. And this is something like what used to happen when Shah of Iran was around. It was the most powerful country. What happens to the status of Saudis? What happens to smaller countries like UAE, for example? You know, we talked about it. It was supposed to be the safe haven for everything, for investments, for trade, you know, for travel. But after this, will the confidence remain the same? In fact, it's funny in a way, because I was just listening to a discussion on Iraq, and they were even talking about what will be the new map of the region after this is all over. So it's fundamental. What's happening now? So the old rules are gone and new rules have not yet emerged. So we are somewhere in the middle right now as we speak.
Let me begin with the larger geopolitical picture. In fact, now the war is moving into its third week. Professor, to you, do you still believe that it could be a temporary one? And then do you have hopes that it could end in the times to come? Or are you concerned that it could lead to a wider confrontation going on months, maybe also years, such as the Russia-Ukraine one?
Look, there are two possibilities here. But first, I think it is very clear that US and Israel on one side and Iran on the other are on what is called as the game of chicken. They are playing the game of chicken. And in international relations, it really matters who chickens out first, who leaves the road first for the other side. With Iran's recent attacks and strategic attempts to threaten its neighbors, I think it is very clear that Iran is not going to buzz anytime soon. And that leaves me a bit worried that the conflict might escalate. Having said that, I think it is still within possible scenario that the conflict will not escalate for a long time. The chances are that it will flare up in terms of its intensity, the casualties, combatants and non-combatants getting killed in this. But in terms of duration, perhaps both the sides will come to this realization that the war is leading them and others, international community, that is including India, to a situation where it will be a futile exercise for all of them.
Mr. Anija, so given the current scenario where we are seeing that both sides are reluctant to put an end to this war, what are some of the critical factors that will determine whether this conflict expands into a wider regional war, or should we be hopeful that the diplomatic channels will be able to contain it?
Tina, I think we are at an inflection point right now, and things can go either way. Now, every war has certain goals. Now, if you look from the Israeli and the American point of view, what were their goals? Their goals were that all missiles, offensive missiles, which Iran possesses, they have to be neutralized, and there should be no threat of a nuclear weapon from Iran. That has not been met. Then there was this hope that once you do a decapitation strike, that is kill the top leadership of Iran, it will result in an uprising, a popular revolt or a color revolution in Iran. Those goals have also not been met. And now it comes to the question of prestige. If you have not, then you're prolonging the war. Second point is from the Iranian side, that they have retaliated very strongly. And it doesn't seem to be, given the way they are attacking the bases, that is American bases in the Gulf, Israel itself, Tel Aviv, Hezbollah, their ally has opened another front, that they are in any way in a position of weakness. So as a result, now we come to the next phase. How do you, if you are from the American and Israeli side, I think there's a time coming whether you'll have to take a call whether you want to put boots on the ground or not. And that is something we have to watch. Boots on the ground is a highly risky affair, which would mean body bags, because Iranians know the terrain, they have the firepower still intact, which would mean something like what happened in the Vietnam War. Once body bags start going to the US, then it creates a domestic problem.
Right.
These are various pivots which we have to watch out for. Boots on the ground or further escalation by Iran. And then if you look at the American side, President Trump has been hinting, he's talking with a forked tongue, but there is also that he says sometimes we won the war, which is a sort of an exit that he wants to get out, and then he says it's unfinished. Then there's a Wall Street Journal article that you need an off-ramp, you know, you need an excuse, so he talks to Putin. So we'll see. There may even be a time when the Israelis and the Americans are not on the same page. So it's in deep flux right now. All these possibilities are there, but I don't see we have any kind of indication that it is tapering down or diplomacy is going to take over.
Okay, so in this context of uncertainty that prevails, perhaps maybe we see the two parties, perhaps Israel and America, not being on the same page in the days to come if that happens. But to understand the geopolitics in the region, we know West Asia has already for long been a theater of competing power centers. But how do you look at the regional alignments now, which involve all the three parties, the United States, Israel, and Iran, but also the other Gulf countries which have been impacted severely this time?
Well, the strategic equilibrium in the region, or dynamics in the region, is also rapidly changing, because Americans and Israelis had three core objectives before they waged a war against Iran. One was, of course, the regime change, and hoping that things will really turn in their favor. That has failed, causing embarrassment to American strategists and policymakers. Second, they were thinking that they will be able to contain or tie Iranians down, that there will be no further military responses. That has also failed. Third is that they thought that they will never be attacked. So American vulnerability, the basis that American bases in the region are this vulnerable that Iran can attack them and therefore present a count of, a kind of counter deterrence, is something very, very interesting. And all the neighbors, all the Gulf countries and Arabian states are watching this carefully, that America is not that powerful at all. I mean, after all, it is also about the capability to make your deterrence or to make your attack so credible that your adversary surrenders. That has not happened. So this, the current scenario and the developments that are unfolding are a signal to all the countries in the Gulf, to the Arab world, that perhaps over-reliance on America is not going to help them in the long run. And therefore, mending ties with Iran is certainly something not at the table at the moment, but certainly something that the Arab world, that the Gulf countries must be thinking, because for all, it is also about their economic security and prosperity. It is their oil refineries and supplies, their exports that are getting massively affected. And so are the regional countries, other countries in the region, countries that are dependent on West Asian oil supply. So I think all in all, this gives a very clear signal to all the countries, middle powers and small powers in the system, that over-reliance on America is something that they have to perhaps reconsider and build their own credible deterrence. Another point that Trump administration initially claimed, that they are going to disarm Iran, which has or which is about to acquire nuclear capabilities. That has also not been proved. So it is more like what happened with Iraq, right? So just another example of their textbook strategy of changing regimes. And when the regime change has also failed, there is nothing that the Americans can prove now, which puts America and its allies in a very embarrassing position. So I agree with Mr. Aneja's point that we have to wait and watch and see whether Americans will send their boots on the ground. But I think American policymakers would not take that Vietnam road, which was not only embarrassing but also fatal in the sense of their military strategy and operations.
Absolutely. And bringing to an end this war and perhaps bringing peace in the region is perhaps the only long-lasting solution. India has been advocating for that solution, Mr. Aneja, for long. But even this time, we're seeing that the manner in which the Prime Minister and the External Affairs Minister are reaching out to every concern, to the leadership of all these countries. Where do you see India coming in when it comes to, say, mediating among these countries? We've already heard leaders of some of these countries pinning hopes on our Prime Minister. that maybe it calls to the warring parties and maybe the war can stop.
So India is actually in a very unique position, and unique in the sense that we have 9 million, 90 lakh workers trapped in the Gulf region. Nobody else. The Russians don't have this problem. Even the Chinese don't have in terms of numbers. So we have to watch out for the security of our people in the Gulf.
And that's being raised time and again
It's being raised, but that is also in a way restricting our room for maneuver, because that is our priority. Tomorrow, in case things go south, we have to do evacuations. We will need the support of all the Gulf countries. So therefore, I see the resolution which we supported yesterday in the UN Security Council. I think we did so because keeping in this mind, because top priority is safety of people. So that explains some way the position which we have taken over there. If you have to avoid it, then we have to play a proactive role in the peace process, in diplomacy. I think which would mean reaching out to all parties. And that would include Iran. And that's happening because the External Affairs Minister, Jaishankar, has had a talk with his counterpart, Mr. Araghchi, on more than one occasion. And then today, Prime Minister Modi and Iranian President Pezeshkian have also have a dialogue. So I think it's good that we've opened the Iran track, because it is important from our overall strategic perspective in terms of our strategic economy and interests that we have excellent equations with all stakeholders. In this case, we have had with Israel. We need equally importantly a very good relationship with Iran as well.
Yes.
For several reasons. One is, of course, oil and gas, people-to-people ties, the route to Afghanistan and Central Asia. So there is a reason to, I'm glad that re-engagement with Iran is starting, which makes us better positioned to do this kind of mediation, or lack of another word, some intervention to resolve this situation. So I think we need to follow this up. Also, I think if you look really little far, if you see the overall change in the Middle East balance of power, right now it looks Iran has the upper hand. And if that happens, Iran is going to emerge as the most important power in the new power. Other countries are going to sort of, adjust to this new reality. So if you have another power emerging, which is Iran, then the trajectory goes in a different direction. Then we are talking about BRICS and, we are talking about Iran, a major civilizational state, joining the BRICS system. So globally, the center of gravity is moving away from the Indo-Pacific and the West to Eurasia. And I think deep down, as strategic thinkers we have in our system, I think it's time we also look that far in defining our response to the current crisis.
So coming to the response to the current crisis and something which is impacting us directly, we've already begun to see how the disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz impacted the global energy market, but also us, because we are one of the world's largest importers. I recall that when the Russia-Ukraine war happened, it's been more than 4 years, but we're still reeling under the impact of the disruption that it caused to the supply chains. Are we worried that this crisis could trigger wider economic instability globally, but impacting us also severely, since this is one of the major routes for our oil and gas supply? So despite the assurances from the government, if this plays out for a longer time, we could be perhaps looking at trouble?
Absolutely. The crisis in West Asia is something that concerns us more in comparison with the Russia-Ukraine crisis, because one, with Russia, we had uninterrupted oil supplies and gas supplies from them, and we had our own bilateral provisions. With Ukraine, we used to import soybean oil and agricultural products, but for that, we had other suppliers. So Russia-Ukraine crisis did not hit us that badly. West Asia, because we have people there, our own citizens working there in the region, we have direct sourcing of oil and gas supplies from the Gulf region, and that makes it more complicated. Third, I think the security scenario, we must not forget the equation that we've had with Iran, and keeping Pakistan in mind. Pakistan and Iran do not have a very good relationship. India had Chabahar port with Iran. So strategic cooperation was, even though it was off again, on again kind of situation with Iran, it was very much on the cards. India has been traditionally a very good friend of Iran and vice versa. So I think this crisis, if it escalates further, both in terms of intensity and duration, this will directly hit us. So India's interests, therefore, are twofold. First, rescue your immediate interests and your people. And then if that is secured, then perhaps use of not mediation, but use your good offices, talking to both Israel and Iran, and try and put an end to this. If not an end, at least de-escalate the crisis. Bring the parties to the table. I think that much India can do, using its good offices, not leading from the front, not playing a very assertive role, but working behind closed doors, working as a kind of facilitator of dialogue.
that is something that only India could do. And that's where India's beauty of Indian diplomacy lies.
Mr. Aneja, let me bring you in here. The former Prime Minister of Australia has written an article wherein he's praised India for hosting leadership of Iran and Israel on not the same platform, but at the same event at the just concluded Raisina dialogue. For a country that can engage with warring parties like Russia and Ukraine simultaneously, that can engage with countries like Iran, Israel and the United States simultaneously, we have strategic interests, we have so many lives at stake because there are Indians working there. But the question here is, do we have the wherewithal, I mean, given the manner in which the diplomacy has played out, given the manner in which we have succeeded in the past to also evacuate our people, what would you expect to be the contingency plan for India in case things go out of control? We've already seen the vulnerability play out in the Strait of Hormuz. And if this escalates, if this goes on for months together, what could be our contingency plan?
It's a tough one, Tina, because you see, when we have done evacuations from Libya, for example, or earlier from Yemen, you know, the numbers are not that correct. Thousands, they were in thousands. Yes. I remember myself when I was in 2006, I saw the evacuation from Beirut taking place. We sent two ships, two warships, we got the people on board, we got all South Asians, including Bangladeshis and others, on, and then we took them to Cyprus, from where they were airlifted back by Air India to back home. But that is a lesser number. If you want to have 9 million, this is an entirely different ball game. Under the stress of a war, you see, you can, if you have a long window, say 6-7 months, you can do it. But if you have to do it under so much of pressure, in that case, then I don't see, it's going to be very difficult. And if that is the case, then we go back to an earlier point, that there is an urgency for us. It is in our self-interest that our diplomacy gets activated in whatever channels we have, with Israel, with Iran, with the US, and importantly with Russia. Russia emerges as a very big player in it, both from an energy security perspective and from a diplomatic perspective. Trump has already spoken to Putin for an off-ramp kind of a solution. So our Russian track also needs to be activated. So we have levers, and I think we have the capacity to do it. But there is an urgency now, but perhaps it is unprecedented. We got to do it fast. And I agree with Professor Rahul. We need to do it. We do it subtly. We do it as a facilitator. We do it as a mediator. In the end, we have to have it something effective and impactful, which gets our people back and which safeguards our other very vital interests in the region and keeps our relationship balanced between Israel and Iran. And that, and a new world order is coming. At least a new regional order is already on the horizon. And also to adapt in the right way, position ourselves well in racing. You should be in a pole position if you want to win the race. So you should be in the pole position, and that would require some creative diplomacy as well, not just crisis management. Perhaps there are opportunities in a crisis.
Okay, so what kind of opportunities, Professor Mishra, you would expect? Our diplomats have always done a brilliant job, be it in evacuation, be it in dealing with the conflict situations. But of course, the evacuation, if it has to happen, will be of a different kind and different scale this time. What are some of the biggest challenges in preparing those contingency plans? Because of course, the priority is to hope that the war stops, and we will do whatever it takes to persuade the warring parties. But if it comes to that kind of a situation wherein we need to evacuate, how difficult is it going to be from the earlier ones that we have carried out so far from different parts of the world, including this region?
Look, Rina, this is a crisis which demands out-of-box solutions, whether it is in terms of scale or in the sense of urgency and emergency that you have in the region and India's direct stakes. All of it demands out-of-box ideas, out-of-box solutions. And perhaps it is also about time when we test our trust and partnership with Israel, to convey to them that, look, if you escalate and if you prolong this conflict, it is going to affect our interests and hurt our people. And maybe, I mean, there is a glimmer of hope that Israelis would also understand that, in this war that they have with Iran, in the crossfire, their trusted partner and ally, as Netanyahu has always said, I mean, repeatedly he has said that India is a trusted partner and brother, and Modi is more like his brother. There is some hope that India would engage with Israel in trying to find a solution, calm the warring parties down. Perhaps it is difficult with the US, but with the region, India has an agency. And that agency comes from India's long-standing involvement and engagement with countries. It's a long-standing partnership, new partnerships that have developed over past 30 years. I mean, imagine this situation in 1990s. India would not talk to Israel, and India would just unilaterally support Iran. Now we are in a position, we are trusted partners of Israel, but we have not left Iran as a friend, as a partner. And we also have cultivated our relationship with UAE, with Oman, with Qatar, with Saudi Arabia. So India has that agency as a leader of Global South, as a country that does not promote these ideas of regime change and violence as a means to find or ensure your self-interest. I think India has that power. India has that capability, provided we use our cards very strategically. And be very clear, I mean, you have to be really do a threadbare analysis here if you are a policymaker deciding India's policy as to how to engage these countries and what should be the sequence, what should be the chronology that you have in mind. So you have to really plan the end game and plan it in such a way that not only your immediate interests are rescued and secured, but also regional peace is ensured. So this is in many ways India's moment to show how crafted and how smart its diplomacy is.
Since you spoke about the immediate security, it takes me to the energy crisis, which is right at our doorstep, Mr. Aneja. Of course, I'm sure the government is facing severe challenges because of the manner in which the crisis is at the doorstep. Then the question here is, how do we address this problem? So what could be the best alternative to ensure that you're still able to fulfill the needs of 1.4 billion people and ensure that the voices and the concerns that are being raised in the country, they're quelled, and that the rumors that are also being spread all across the country? These are initial stage, but if this continues for a long time, it'll be difficult for the government to provide answers. What is it that you think could be the best alternative given the current scenario, both in the West Asian region, but also the manner in which we've been engaging with our longtime partner Russia in meeting with our energy needs?
When it comes to energy, I think Russia is key. And I'm glad that we already were buying Russian oil. And despite all the pressures while we were negotiating for a trade deal with the Americans, we did not come under pressure. Maybe we reduced a little bit, but the pipeline, that is the flow of Russian oil, kept coming to India. We need to ride on that because Russia has the oil. The route which it takes, that is the transportation, doesn't come from the Gulf side. It comes from the Russian Far East, Vladivostok, and then south towards Bay of Bengal, Chennai, and then US. That is not getting interrupted. So Russia will be key. Second thing is, I think this dialogue between the Prime Minister and President Pezeshkian, and yesterday's or day before yesterday's talks between the two foreign ministers, is very important because we need to get this exemption or a gesture from the Iranians that our ships will not, coming out of the Strait of Hormuz, will not be harmed. If we can do that, Russia plus standing with Iran in the current scenario, then I think we are still okay on the oil side. I'm a little worried on the gas side. And, you know, because we were buying a lot of Qatari gas. There was a time there was negotiations going on both in Iran and Qatar of gas. We were even thinking of a gas pipeline at that time from Iran. But we chose whatever it is. That is going to be a challenge. So somehow we also got to make sure that the Qatari gas starts coming again. And we resolve that part as well. So I think oil, I'm not so worried. Gas is a matter of concern, which right now we'll have to see. We'll have to work it out, somehow get the Qataris into this equation, that they start, which would mean an understanding between the Qataris and Iranians. So that is the first, perhaps a diplomatic channel, how to get these two together and get the gas flowing for us from an energy security point of view.
As we speak, I'm sure the best minds are already at work thinking of some options, but what would be your guess? What are some of the best possible options that we are exploring to ensure that the crisis scenario which is at our doorstep, and especially in context of gas, is met with? The parliament is already in session and government will be held accountable, and the parliament is in session until the next few weeks. So what could be some of the probable options that you think are policymakers are already exploring?
I absolutely agree with Mr. Aneja's point. Qatari gas and securing Russian supplies is essential. But I think perhaps India should focus more on Strait of Malacca now. Mm-hmm. And secure supplies from Brunei, for example, which is also one of the leading gas suppliers. Reach out to Indonesia, reach out to Malaysia. Perhaps Australia could be a partner. So there are alternative routes of or alternative supplies of gas that India should perhaps work on. Brunei could be a very good partner. Prime Minister visited the country recently, and India and Brunei have an agreement on gas supply. So I think those channels need to be activated and secure alternative routes. that is in addition to what India has to do in the Gulf region.
Absolutely. So while we hope that peace prevails in the region and that the warring sides at least agree to a temporary ceasefire and come to the dialogue table. Thank you, Professor Mishra, Ms. Daneja, for joining us for this very engaging conversation.
You were listening to a discussion on expanding conflict in West Asia and its global repercussions. The participants were Atul Aneja, strategic analyst, and Professor Rahul Mishra, international affairs expert. The moderator was Tina Jha, journalist. This program was produced and presented by the News Services Division of Akashvani.
Current Affairs.